Hey, what's good? This is Rich, and you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, where we make conversations about personal finance and business easy to understand, all while having some fun along the way. Marcus is off this week, but he will be back next week for our last episode of 2019. Come on now, we ain't going anywhere. So we do have some exciting updates to share, things that we're thinking about for 2020. Definitely looking forward to having that conversation, so stay tuned. As for today's show, making more money is top of mind, and I'm chatting with someone that's done that well. Nick Loper is the founder of Side Hustle Nation, a super helpful blog, podcast, and Facebook community for those looking to put some extra money in their pockets through side hustles. And what I loved about this conversation beyond the helpful nuggets is that Nick started interviewing me during the episode, which I'd have to say is a PMB first. So here's my chat with Nick, and I hope you enjoy. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
So tell the good people at a PMB family a little bit about yourself.
How far back should we go? I host the Side Hustle Show, which has been running for since 2013. It explores creative ways to make extra money outside of your day job. And I'm constantly amazed by the different methods and marketing tactics and creative ideas that people come up with to do that. Initially, I was worried of like, oh, I'm going to run out of people to talk to. No, that's not going to happen. It's like a never-ending stream of really fun business ideas there. There's a blog component that goes along with that over at sidehustlenation.com, which kind of started out similarly with like, hey, this is going to be my own experiences or experiments in this space, has kind of evolved a little bit to showcase other people's stories as well, just like the podcast. The whole project was born as a side project from the original side hustle of mine, which was a comparison shopping site for footwear back in the day. And that was the vehicle that let me quit my job. It was 3 years of nights and weekends hustling on the side for my corporate gig to eventually become a full-time online shoe salesman.
How did you even get into that with the side hustle?
It started with an internship of mine with this company in Seattle that was one of the pioneering footwear retailers online. It was actually started, they had like a brick and mortar shoe store in Seattle, and then they had this wild and crazy idea in the early days of the internet to put some of their inventory online. And by the time I came on board as their marketing intern, of course, the online portion of their business had just grown by, you know, leaps and bounds compared to the little tiny brick and mortar store that they had. And so they put me in charge of pay-per-click advertising, of the affiliate program. Those were my first exposure to e-commerce, to SEO, to all this stuff. And so after that internship ended, I said, well, you know, I had this inside glimpse into their affiliate program. I could become an affiliate of theirs, and I could become an affiliate of all these other shoe stores as well. And so I started doing direct link pay-per-click ads. I don't even know if this is still a thing, but it was a way to get started in affiliate marketing and making money online without having a website. So I could bid on these like very specific keywords, like in my case, models of shoes, like, you know, New Balance. New Balance was great for this because they all have like very specific model names. New Balance model XYZ. And then I would point that ad to whoever had the best price using my affiliate link and kind of played this game in between what I would hopefully earn in commissions minus what I would spend on advertising. And then ultimately scaled that up to build out a full-fledged website that had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of brands and ran these comparison tables of like, hey, you know, here's the best place to get the best deal on your next pair of shoes.
You mentioned affiliate marketing. So one, can you define that for folks? And then two, that's not something that the average young up-and-comer is thinking about. So how did you even find out that affiliate marketing was a thing?
Well, it was through that internship. That was kind of my first exposure to it. But affiliate marketing is probably worth defining. This is the art and science of helping other companies sell their products and services online. So Amazon runs probably the web's largest affiliate program. They call it Amazon Associates. And so if you look up any physical product and the word review or reviews or this product versus this product, you're likely going to land on an affiliate website where they're going to tell you the pros and cons. They're going to tell you what they liked, what they didn't like. And then they're going to link that to Amazon using their Amazon Associates link. And if you buy it, they'll collect a percentage of that sale.
Got it. I have a love and hate, but mainly hate relationship with Amazon affiliates because I think I'm one of those people who was like, oh, this sounds awesome. And I signed up for it too soon. And then I didn't meet that minimum threshold and they closed my account and I can't open it again. So I'm doing this dance, and I hope no one from Amazon is listening, where every now and then I'm trying to find a different email address to open the account up based off of whatever business thing I have going on at that time so that I can take advantage of it again. And with that said, do you think that's something that people should hold off on for a little while before they sign up for it to make sure that they actually have some traction, given that Amazon does have that 60 or 90 day window where you have to generate a certain amount? Otherwise, your account will get that nah.
I didn't realize that. That must be a new thing. So they're saying if you don't make a sale within a couple months, like, you must not be serious. We're going to close you down.
Yeah, pretty much. And I don't think it's just one sale, but there's a certain dollar amount that you need to hit in terms of referral or affiliate dollar amounts. And when did you sign up for Amazon affiliates?
Yeah, probably like 2005 or something.
Oh, yeah. So I imagine it's a lot different. They realize how many people are signing up. They want to limit the number of people. Well, they want the most people possible, but they want the most serious people possible. So yes, they have put limits on it, and that has made it a little bit more challenging for those who are just getting started, who don't already have a funnel of people who are then going through and making purchases.
Interesting. Well, one workaround for Amazon, I believe for Amazon and for any other affiliate program that you can't get into, especially when you're just starting out, I use a service called VigLink, V-I-G-Link, which I think just rebranded, but that redirect will get you to this site. So they act as the affiliate network for thousands and thousands of companies, and they take a percentage of your sales. So you're going to get less commission than you would if you went directly, but you can have access to hundreds and hundreds of programs without these individual applications in most cases.
Got it. And if somebody is thinking about, and we'll talk a bit more about your story, your background, how you got to where you are, things that people need to consider with starting a side hustle. But since we're on the topic of these affiliate networks, how does somebody, if someone has no experience in this area, and maybe they don't even have a website, and that could be a whole conversation in itself with building, creating a website, the brand and everything that goes into it. But where would you recommend that someone start? And so maybe there are things that they're super interested in, like myself. I'm a tech geek when it comes to podcasting and just technology in general. So microphones, other tech related to podcasting. I have a couple of websites that are out there. So it's simple enough for me to write a post and link to those things. But if somebody is kind of starting from scratch, what's the best way for them to get started?
Man, the best way, or probably the fastest way to do it without a website, although you may still need, you know, at least a placeholder website to get approved. But the fastest way, especially for product reviews right now, is YouTube. So it's like, hey, I'm going to compare this microphone versus this microphone, this mattress versus this mattress. I just came across one this week that was like this hair loss pill versus this hair loss pill. It was like, you know, comparing different things. It was like, oh, this is a fantastic niche. And they had this whole system for, you know, their whole site was built around these comparisons. And I was like, these are great, you know, buyer intent keywords that somebody is going to be searching in, like this product versus this product. And because not that many people were writing about it, recording videos about it, they ended up ranking pretty well in Google. The site was only a year old and they were pulling in, they told me, 20 grand a month in commissions. I was like, holy crap. Like, to be able to go from zero to 20 grand a month with some obviously dedicated effort and putting a lot of time into creating this content, but like something that didn't exist a year ago and now you're pulling in that kind of revenue, it's crazy inspiring and it's just plain crazy. On the other hand, where it's like, you know, 20 years ago, it's like, okay, I got to open a brick and mortar store. I got to sign a lease. And it's like all this stuff, you know, very low overhead these days.
YouTube is something that's a burden for a lot of people. And I'd even throw myself into this bucket where it feels like I got to have the background with the bookshelf and I can't have the noise and the kids passing by. And I think of the video where that dude was giving an interview and then his youngest daughter came into the room and then the baby came in and then the mom had to pull him out. So I can't have that type of stuff happening. So that said, is there any advice that you'd give to someone who's really anxious about putting themselves out there on YouTube?
I was really hesitant to do YouTube for a long time and I'm still kind of working through my YouTube strategy. But some of my early videos, and these are some of the ones that have kind of performed the best, are just screen share videos, like screen capture. videos or screen recording videos with me doing voiceover. So if you don't want to put your face on camera, if you don't want to worry about like the fancy backdrop and like the bokeh camera and the DSLR and all these settings and stuff, like just do the screen recording. And that kind of those types of like tutorial videos have done really well. Like I have a video on like how to create a folder in Gmail. Like basic stuff still gets tons of views. And I was looking at like the AdSense or the, you know, Google ad revenue for that video. It was like 10 or 15 bucks a month, like straight passive income for something I created 4 or 5 years ago. That is just, you know, it's not me on camera. It's just these random ones. And maybe you make that a rule of if you come across a problem in your own life and then you figure out how to solve it, like, could you make a piece of content about that? I have another video on like how to prevent Dropbox from like eating up all your local storage, right? It was like, ooh, oh, you know,
I got to watch that
some
one.
Setting like to, you know, stop it from doing this like syncing all the time. And it was like, okay, this is easy. And like that video gets a ton of views and generates, you know, a little bit of passive income every month. It's just, you know, solving these little problems and because somebody is typing that in. And if you can help them with that, it starts to, the algorithm starts to work in your favor.
And you made me think of something here because a lot of times these things seem so basic. So what you just described, that sounds super basic to me. And it's something that's super basic to you. And this is something that I've struggled with over the years. And I think others struggled with where they feel like something is so basic that everyone already has the answer to it. Or there's already so many people out there doing that. So what do you say to those folks who maybe feel like what they know is so basic that it's already been covered, so it doesn't make sense for them to put something out there on that same topic?
Yeah, this is called the curse of knowledge, and it is very much a thing where it's like, it's hard to imagine not knowing that. And we have a couple young kids, and it's like, okay, 2 + 2 = 4. Like, how do you not get that? Like, it's hard to imagine not being in a position of not knowing that, but there's another member of Side Hustle Nation who's got a math tutoring, like since we're talking about math, he's got a math tutoring channel on YouTube. And he's grown this thing, you know, through dedicated effort to thousands and thousands of views. And it's become a nice little incremental income stream. And he does, you know, one-on-one tutoring as his main business. And so it drives customers to him, plus he drives ad revenue. It's a really interesting business model where it's like, if you can create this content, and maybe it doesn't have to be necessarily different, but could you present it in a compelling way? Or like, hey, here's my personal story with solving this. There's always room for more stuff out there. It's crazy because it's like, you know, he started in 2016, 2017. Like, you know, YouTube had already been around for 10 years. You know, it's not like he was not the first person to talk about how to solve math problems. It's just an interesting space.
Yeah. And I hope people take something away from that. I know that I've been dragging it. And YouTube video, it really is the way of the future in terms of what we hear out there. Of course, audio, podcasting, and Medium that we're both part of, that's going to continue to grow. But there's still a lot of opportunity out there for folks to be able to create video and not ultimately put their face out there as well. And getting back to your story, you got this shoe affiliate business that you're building on the side while you're also working your day gig. So at what point did you start having the, you know what, this could really become the main thing?
There was a couple moments there. The first was the first month that it like completely covered my expenses. So I was living in Atlanta and my mortgage was like $700 and I was, you know, had a company car and I was like traveling a little bit for work. So I didn't have a ton of extra expenses, but call it $1,000 a month that I was spending at that point. In the first month that the business made $1,000 was like this super empowering and like freeing moment, you know, more mindset wise than anything else. It was like the entire paycheck is gravy. Like if this job goes away, like I'm okay. And that was a really empowering place to be. And then the second moment was when I finally like felt comfortable giving my notice to my boss, like I'm out of here, man. And that was when, you know, I wanted to see a track record of revenue that exceeded my monthly expenses. So by that time, we'd moved to California. Expenses had gone up naturally. And, you know, I wanted to see a revenue history that covered that for, you know, the past 6 or 12 months trailing. And then with that, I was confident with an extra 40, 50 hours a week that that I could get it to the salary and beyond. Like I could replace that income and beyond if I have more time to dedicate to it.
And you mentioned sales, or no, you mentioned having a company car. So that sounds like you were probably in sales. Is that right?
Yes.
How was the sales life? Because I did sales too. I've got thoughts on it. I know what my personality is as an introvert. And while it was all about the numbers, so as long as, at least for me, as long as I hit my numbers, no one bothered me. I could go home at 2. I could not work a day as long as I was hitting my numbers. But during those busy seasons where things might have been a bit more challenging, I found myself working a lot harder. And then I also felt the pressure a bit. So there's that balance of freedom that you get when you're achieving versus the constant hustle, dialing for dollars, trying to get in front of decision makers or get in front of families, depending on what you're selling. What was that experience like for you?
So I was in the car business and I was on the factory side. So I was a dealer rep for Ford. And the interesting thing, it was a sales organization that didn't necessarily act like a sales organization in terms of compensation. Like you could hit your numbers, you could not hit your numbers. They were going to pay you the same, which was demotivating in a way. Like I want to be performance driven. Like if I want to bust my butt, like I want to see an impact on that. And that was what I was seeing on the side with the shoe business. Like if I spent the whole weekend like making new ads for these products, like I could see the benefits of that in my bottom line for weeks or months down the road, where I just wasn't getting that at the day job. So it was tough as an introvert. Car business, fascinating business. Love the people that I worked with. Sometimes I'd be calling on dealers who have been in business for generations. And it was just fascinating to go in there and see kind of their perspective on this business and all the nuance that goes into it. But it was also difficult at 22, 23 years old to be like, yeah, you should listen to me, you know, because Mr. Dealer, I know you had your charter signed by Henry Ford, but you know, I got some fresh ideas you should pay attention to.
It's funny you say that because I think about some of the horrible experiences that I had because I was young too. I was doing it also right out of school. And I think that there's a lot of experience that comes with sales, but I can remember some of the nightmare, not presentations where I necessarily fumbled, but where I just dealt with some really difficult people or I felt disrespected. So did you have any crazy sales stories where you went to pitch to someone and you maybe wanted to punch them in the face or you walked out like, you know what, this really isn't for me?
I don't know. That's a challenge too, because some of the stuff that you're trying to sell and make a business case for, the pushback is like, you know, you're asking us to put our money in the line to invest in this inventory that's unproven, that, you know, we can get from an aftermarket supplier for half the cost. Like it was just, you know, they had some very good objections where I was like, you, and here I am like nodding along, you make a good case, Mr. Dealer. And it's like, you know, had I been better at overcoming objections or more drinking the company Kool-Aid, it would have been like, no, here's why, you know, our solution really is the best. And that was something that probably made me not so great at that job. And even my boss told me, and I remember this, we're driving over the San Mateo Bridge. And he's like, because I transferred from Atlanta, and he's like, you know, the scouting report on you is that you'll never be an all-star.
He said that to you?
He said that to me. I was like, why? You know, first of all, like, are you telling me that to motivate me? Or are you telling me that you kind of want me out of here? Like, what's your game plan, boss? It was an interesting moment. You know, you'll never be an all-star. And I was like, well, I don't know if I want to be at a place where I can never be an all-star.
And was this in a car?
Yeah, we were driving to a dealer meeting together.
That's a really awkward car ride. How do you get...
that's a long bridge.
How do you go into a meeting after that when your boss has just told you... He didn't go as far as saying you'll never amount to anything, but your boss has just told you that you'll never be the best. How do you keep your game face on and go into a meeting with that conversation looming in the background?
I mean, thankfully, I already had the side hustle going at that point. So it was like, you know, always in the back of my mind that I wanted to get out of there anyways. And that was definitely another point in favor of making that leap.
And were you married at that time?
And not married, but dating my eventual wife.
Okay. Because I was going to ask, when you got to the point, well, one, when you had the conversation with your boss and said, yo, I'm out of here, how'd that go? But then I was also going to ask, because I know for a lot of people, when they go independent, sometimes they have a family to think about and they need to bring that significant other along for that journey and essentially sell them on why this is going to work. So I know you all were just dating at the time, but curious if that was a conversation that came up for you. And then also, how did that conversation go down with the boss who told you that you would never be the best?
So we were, my girlfriend and I, we were living together. At the time, we had a condo here in Livermore, and she's always been so supportive of these crazy projects. I mean, she looked at the numbers and we were living below our means. So like, if it all went to hell, we could survive on her salary. I mean, that's kind of how we've always tried to approach things. Like, could we live on one income? And instead of letting our lifestyle creep up to the level that it potentially could as salaries and business earnings have gone up, like, no, let's try and keep things lean just in case. And that's actually proven to be really beneficial, like, you know, towards our, you know, FIRE numbers and all that stuff. As far as the conversation with the boss, this was a really hard conversation to have, even though I kind of had this like fallback plan. It's still like, we were out to dinner, we were up in Eureka traveling again on another dealer visit. And I was on the second beer before I finally got up the nerve to be like, look, man, I'm out of here.
Sounds about right.
When I finally got it off my chest and finally got off the nerve to say it, it was like, you know, this huge weight, this huge burden off my shoulders. It just felt so freeing.
I can imagine. I am still in the corporate world. There will come a day, I know, there will come a day where I have to have that conversation. And I think it'll go a little bit differently because I don't hate my job now and don't anticipate hating it for the rest of the time that I'm doing it, hopefully. And so you mentioned money there and living below your means. You also mentioned FIRE. So what was your experience with money growing up? Because that's pretty responsible, because I can tell you when I came out of school, I was doing sales. I wasn't even making crazy money, but I was pretty irresponsible. I was irresponsible for like a decade. I didn't become fully responsible, and I'm still not fully responsible now, but I didn't become more responsible until probably the last 5 to 6 years or so. What was your experience with money growing up to where you were able to live below your means and do that comfortably, or maybe it was uncomfortable?
I think we both came, my wife and I both came from a long line of savers. So we both grew up in relatively frugal families. And of course, looking back now on both sides, on her side and mine, like, I think our parents were maybe better off than they let on, or at least maybe now that they're empty nesters, like, they're letting loose a little bit. It's like, okay, you know, you kind of see like what that savings mentality, that frugal mentality can lead to down the road. Like, oh, okay, now you're comfortable and you're not asking us for help, which is like, I know some people are in the opposite position, and we're very grateful that that's not the case for us. My parents were very conscious on money in a few different ways. Dad encouraged us to like buy mutual funds like at an early age, probably like in middle school. He's like, yeah, you know, get some of this, you know. And of course, it was like during the tech bubble, so it was like, hey, you know, during the first year, it's like, hey, this is fantastic. Investing is fantastic. Look, I just doubled my money. And then the next year, it's like, oh, investing sucks. Like, I just lost half my money. But that was good to see. Like so he encouraged that early on. They encouraged me to get a credit card early on. It's probably as soon as I turned 18 to start building credit. And they made a point of explaining, like, dude, don't spend money you don't have. Like, that's not how this works. Like, just use it as a debit card, basically. They were very, I don't want to say encouraging, but like, they gave me a long enough leash to let me make some questionable decisions, or like the long enough leash to try and fail at some stuff. So I ended up buying a rental property right out of college. Maybe I was still in college. And it was one of these like lease option deals, like during the real estate boom. It's like, how could a college kid with no income get a loan? Like, that's the, you know, that's the boom that we were in. And it's like, well, I got these tenants already in place. Like, it'll be fine. And, you know, I know my dad is just like shaking his head. Like, he never wanted to be a landlord. Like, he's like, I've never been, you know, why would I do that? And I was like, hey, you know, I'm drinking the real estate investment Kool-Aid. Like, this is going to be great. And he's probably like, all right, man, it's your money. You see what happens with this. And thankfully it worked out okay. But, you know, so they've always had the encouragement to try stuff out and given us the freedom to make those mistakes.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like they were doing all right behind the scenes, Because those are some pretty responsible tactics. And even hearing getting a credit card early on and them being frugal and being savers, there are probably some things they were doing right. And they probably were thinking about retirement and you and if you had siblings, them being out the house and living that glory life later on. But this idea of getting a credit card early, so that means you did not get to college and then get got by the Frisbee or the free T-shirt and sign up for a credit card. You already had a credit card and you were using it responsibly. So when you saw those tables set up and those representatives, that was probably nothing to you.
Yeah. Now that knowing what I know now about like what credit card sign up bonuses can really be worth in terms of, you know, free cash and travel, because I do have like, I have a Mariners like bucket hat that I got at like Fan Fest or something. And it was like, this was the sign up bonus. Like now you can get like $800 worth of sign up bonuses if you do it right. It's like, this was the thing that they got me hooked in with. Yeah. I mean, using credit responsibly. So, I mean, very, very grateful to never have gotten into any debt trouble on that front.
And how have your views on money changed over the years? And I'd say from maybe when you were out of school to where you're at now, where you're working for yourself and you can take time off, how have your, maybe both you and your wife, how have your thoughts changed on money? Or are you still operating the same since it sounds like you were already fairly responsible back then?
I think we started off with a good initial ground game. One thing that was maybe a little bit of a turning point was discovering Mr. Money Mustache and this like concept of early retirement or at least early financial independence, which I think can be discouraging for some people. Like, oh, I got to save 25 times my annual income. But for us, it was like, oh, that gives us something to shoot for. Like that gives us a concrete thing to shoot for that may not be that far off in the broad scheme of things. So that was kind of motivating. And it allowed us to tackle it from both sides. Like, okay, if we stopped spending money on this, or if we were more conscious about spending money on this, you know, what would that mean for us? And in that same time, you know, what can we do to increase our income? Like, I don't know, that's been really empowering. I've been on a mission to, you know, not just grow the business, but to like build this like dividend portfolio, which I know is like not the most tax efficient thing. You got to do what's exciting for you. Like you probably get the people, oh, should I pay off my mortgage or should I invest that money somewhere else? It's like, do whatever is exciting for you. If the concept of a paid off house is like a cool like goal to shoot for, then pay off the house. Same thing with, so like, you know, I've been buying these like dividend stocks and building up this little passive dividend portfolio. Cause it's like, I can talk about passive income all day long on the blog and website, but it's like, I'm still working at that stuff. Like, yeah, it's time leveraged and yeah, it can be passive, but it's like, if I let it go for years, of course it would die a slow death. Like some of these stocks have been paying dividends for a century. And it's like, this is true passive income. And that's exciting for me.
Now, you said something there that might be confusing to some folks. So you talked a little bit about having a dividend portfolio. So one, what is a dividend or a dividend portfolio? What does that mean? But then also what you'll commonly hear is that you put money in the stock market and you just let it stay there and you ride it out over 25, 30 years till retirement, whatever it is, some long time horizon.
Yeah.
Whereas with this, you mentioned that if you just let it sit there and you don't touch it at all, you don't manage it at all, it could die a slow, painful death. So why is that the case there?
Well, that's specifically with the case of the online business, where it's like, okay, this site ranks in Google today, but if I stop putting out the podcast, you know, slowly the listenership goes somewhere else. If I stop putting out new content, slowly Google says, okay, this site is dead, right? So it's like, it's passive in terms that like stuff I wrote 2 years ago could still get traffic. But, you know, there's an upkeep involved to that. On the dividend side, dividend stocks are, you know, in my case, I'm going after these like blue chip companies that have a long track record of not just paying dividends, but increasing their dividends every year. So these are like old, boring companies like AT&T, Target, Chevron, Coca-Cola, right? Like household names that have been around forever. The exciting thing to me there was I'm always the person who thinks the market is going to crash tomorrow. Like it's, you know, we're 10 years deep into a bull market. Like it's due, right? And so, you know, I started saying this like 5 years ago, like, I don't want to invest now because like, it's going to crash, right? Like that's what it's like. And it goes back to like the NASDAQ crash in like 2000, right? Because I, you know, lived through that and then 2008. And so it's like, you know, I just have this risk aversion. But buying for the cash flow instead allowed me to get off the sidelines and have slowly built that up. And that's been a way for me to, you know, not just get those dividends, but like also to get the gains over the last 4 or 5 years too.
Got it. And so with the dividends, that essentially means that, the company is paying out some amount to the stockholders. And is it happening at the time of their quarterly call?
I'm not sure the exact timing of it, but typically it's every quarter.
Okay, got you. Now let's talk a little bit about side hustling, the main topic du jour for the day. I know at this point, side hustling has become a sexy term. We always hear people talking about the hustle, the side hustle, there's courses, things like that. And for folks who have a day job, they may feel that they're especially busy, or they may have other misconceptions about starting a side hustle. So what are some of the biggest misconceptions that you've come across and maybe had to debunk, and how can people overcome them?
Well, maybe some of the big things to debunk is the hustle term of like, I'm going to scam people. I got hustled. When I say hustle, and I think when you say hustle, it's more like controlling what you can control and, you know, putting in your effort. It comes from an old baseball coach of mine, at least in my case. He's like, look, you're going to have bad days at the plate. You're going to have bad days in the field, but hustle never slumps, right? Like this is one element of your game that you can always 100% control. And so that stuck with me. It's like, so that's side hustle nation. It's like, okay, you may not have total control over your day job. And maybe you think that's a risky position to be in. You do have control in how you spend your spare time. And so why not use it to build something that you care about, build something productive, build something that maybe brings you some income.
I love that. And now, no matter how somebody goes about it, starting a side hustle takes time. I've tried various things. I've done the side hustle. I think I did a soundbite for an episode of yours a while back about when I was doing resume consulting back in 2006. But it feels like no matter what, starting a side hustle takes time. Like you can't get around that. So how did you create the time, given that you were working by day and you had a relationship? And how do you continue to create that time for yourself, where I'm guessing it's probably a little bit easier now, given that you do have a number of income streams?
Yeah, it's easier in some ways and harder in others. Like I can tell you the grass is always greener. Like even once you become a full-time entrepreneur, there's still not going to be enough time in the day to get done everything that you want to do, which is frustrating. It's like, there's always more to do. And I think part of that is how ideas tend to come to you once you're already in motion and you have these conversations and you're like, oh, I should be doing this. I could be doing, like, I want to test this thing out. So that's a challenge. But the truth is, like, we will always make time for the things that are priorities to us. And so I've been trying to get more honest with myself, because I was the person who I didn't have enough time for that. I'm sorry. For whatever reason, didn't have enough time. That was always my excuse. What I've tried to start saying instead, and this is, I still catch myself sometimes, is I prioritized something else. And that's the real truth. I prioritized something else. And it's maybe a little brutally honest in some cases, or maybe it's like, yeah, I prioritized spending time with my kids or whatever it is. Like, there's no judgment. It's just like, you make time for your priorities. For me, it was pretty consistently in the early days, like, you know, get home, go to the gym, make dinner, clean up, all that stuff. And then like 7 to 10, was hustle time. And, you know, that was, you know, during the early days of building the website and getting the ads off the ground and stuff like that. I'm curious for you, like even with the paychecks and balances, like how do you carve out the time? It's something you guys have been doing for years. So it must be a priority for you.
Yes. And it's actually coming up on 6 years of Marcus and I podcasting together, which is insane.
That's awesome.
I know. And then over, I said, I know that sounds pompous. Like, yeah, damn right. It's awesome.
Well, because I mean, you probably have seen the stats of like the average show lasts 7 episodes before people are like, this is too hard. I give up.
We're taking a quick break from my chat with Nick to tell you about today's sponsors.
The next round of holidays are around the corner, which means travel season is still upon us. And with as much as I've touched the sky this year, compact and smartly designed luggage with wheels that can roll with the punches has been clutch. That's why I love my Away Bigger Carry-On suitcase. The lightweight, durable shell was built for a lifetime of travel, which means I won't need to replace it in a couple years because of rips or normal wear and tear. And if my suitcase does get damaged, Away has a limited lifetime warranty, so I'm getting it fixed or replaced. For $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/paychecks and use promo code paychecks during checkout. Again, that's awaytravel.com/paychecks and promo code paychecks at checkout for $20 off. If after 100 days you aren't happy, you can return the suitcase as long as you haven't personalized it with stickers or other custom markings. The University of California Irvine's winter registration is open. UCI's online classes offer the flexibility and convenience you need and an immersive classroom experience to stay focused. UCI's courses are taught by industry experts with real-world experience and span a range of topics like marketing, leadership, and project management. If you're thinking about getting a new role in the new year, make sure you have the skills and knowledge to set you apart. It's competitive out there, and one of UCI's certificate or specialized study programs could be the difference maker. To check out their offerings and sign up for a course, visit ce.uci.edu/paychecksbalances and enter paychecks at checkout for 15% off one course. That's ce.uci.edu/paychecksbalances and enter promo code paychecks for 15% off one course. This offer is only valid through December 31st, 2019 at 11:59 p.m. And now, back to the show.
Consistency has definitely been the major key. And I think part of what's allowed us to be sustainable is that we actually care about the topic and care about what it is that we're trying to accomplish. So ultimately, we both want to help people. We both want to share the mistakes that we've made over the years. And if we can help one person not make some of those same mistakes, or if they have made some of those mistakes, know that it's okay and that they can bounce back. That's something that keeps us going. So I think having those core values and kind of that core mission, because it's going to be difficult. Like, I'd imagine even for you over the course of the years, there's been times where you're like, oh, I don't feel like freaking recording this episode right now. Or you're in the West Coast too. So, this guest is only available at this time. And I got other stuff I'd rather be doing at this time. So now I got to schedule with them and record with them. And it's super inconvenient. But ultimately, you know that there's something greater that you're moving to. And for us, beyond the consistency, it's really been about process and systems. And it's taken us years to figure that out. So coming up with a workflow so that we're saving mental time and energy every week and not trying to think through all the million steps that it takes to produce a podcast. And what's been particularly helpful for us over the past probably year or so, given that our day jobs have gotten significantly busier, is that we had to hire help. And I know for people starting out, that's not something that they may immediately want to do because they're not even sure if their idea is proven yet and they don't necessarily want to make that investment. A lot of people want to start and launch things on the free and not put money into their business, knowing that a lot of times it does take some money to be able to make money. And for us, I think we both realized that we were becoming increasingly busy. And so for editing, I'm a tech geek. I love editing. I love the production side of things. I love the behind the scenes. But I also realized that that wasn't my highest use of time. And I had to make the decision to get an editor. And that ended up getting me back probably 10 to 15 hours per month, if not more. That freed time up for us to focus on the production side of things. Same for Marcus as well. And then there are times on the weekend that we have block now. So we use Calendly, which is a scheduling service. And we block out that on Saturdays and Sundays, these are the times that we can do it. We're not going to make times available during the week unless we absolutely have to, because we both have day jobs and we're on different time zones. So let's set aside these times. And that way we know every week, even if nothing is scheduled as of a few days beforehand, every week there's a possibility that we're going to need to record at these specific times. And here's the cadence for everything that needs to happen between the time that we record and the time that that episode gets released. So really a lot of what's allowed us to be able to do this is the forward thinking and planning around the workflow so that we're not spinning our wheels trying to figure out, okay, I got the episode. I need to edit it. Okay, what do I need to do next? All right, I got to upload it. Okay, I got to create the show notes. That's all in checklists so we can automatically do it. And then even with my girlfriend now, it's actually, we were just having the conversation last night and she was asking if I was going to be free today. And I said, hey, every Saturday from this time, I will, unless it's like with somebody who, unless it's like Barack or somebody else highly influential, I will never have a podcast recording after a certain time. Like that is the cutoff. And then I want to be able to enjoy my life, enjoy my time with you, do whatever it is I want to do, even if that's just sitting on the couch. So how about for you? How do you think about it?
Yeah, that's a good way to do it. Actually, kind of the combination of time blocking, say like, this is the dedicated time for these tasks. And, you know, having a cutoff point, that's actually really mature of you to say like, oh, I'm done at this hour and shut down. And now it's like, you know, Rich's time to do whatever else. Because it's easy to just work and work and work. And there's always, like we talked about, there's always more to do. But I do like that. I do, obviously, the systems and processes are something that come to you over time. I am totally that person who would do everything the cheap way, the free way, the frugal way. I'll do it myself first. And I don't want to hire help until I have revenue to justify that. So I think that makes perfect sense. Like, hey, once you reach a certain point, then it's time to bring on the editing help or the virtual assistant help, whatever it is that makes sense in your business. And if it's a service business, like maybe that's, you know, the subcontractor that can do the work for you. So there's always room for hiring help and people who are willing to help you out. You know, I've got a handful of virtual team members that helped me out with the show and with other elements of the business, but that wasn't the case early on. Early on, it was doing everything myself.
Now, the virtual assistant has been major key. I just mentioned the editor, and we were able to find our virtual assistant within the FinCon community. And it was at a conversation at one of those dinners. And I find for a lot of this stuff, it's all about the networks, the people you meet, the power referral, word of mouth. And I think it was FinCon last year, actually, where we started talking to folks. Hey, we're looking for a virtual assistant. Who do you know? And we had someone, Amy, who said, hey, I actually might be able to help you out there. And nice. We went back and forth with her, and you know, she ended up becoming our virtual assistant, which has been a huge time saver for me, especially because when I'm at the day job, it's almost this conflict of interest in a way, because there's everything that's happening with paychecks and balances in the background, whether it's sponsors or you probably get those emails, love to post article on your website. I remember getting to a point where it's like, I need someone who can just say no to all this foolishness that's coming in. Like it's just endless mental churn for me to try and go and research and see if this is legit.
You're so polite to even respond to those. I just round file them.
Well, yeah. And then some of them, it's automated. So you get three or four emails and then I just become irritated, even though all I have to do is not read them. And so to me, it's like, if I can remove this one area of irritation by having someone else manage it and having that stuff just be funneled out of my inbox altogether, then fantastic. And yes, I probably am a little bit nicer, and being nice has probably cost me extra time and in some ways extra money. But I think about the times where something comes in and it's truly time sensitive. Maybe it's a potential sponsor that reaches out, or it's the company that helps secure sponsorships for us. And they need a timely response because the client is on a short timeline to get their campaign launched. And I'll be at work. It honestly might not be till the next day that I have a chance to look at that email. And then there's also the conflict of being at work and trying to jump out and use work time to do podcast work, or use work time to jump on calls, which is super dicey. Like, I never want to be in a conference room having a podcast call and my boss happens to walk in and then I'm presenting some podcast stats on the screen or something like that. So having a virtual assistant has been super helpful, because now she's been with us long enough, and I'm also a documentation monster. So all like the basic recurring processes and things that I do on a regular basis, I write down in granular detail all the steps so that it's easy to hand off. And it's also easy for me to see where I can pull myself out and say, you know what, is this something that only I can do, or that I would do the best? Or is this something that someone else can do, and them doing it isn't going to have any type of negative impact on the business overall. So how do you think about how you leverage your virtual assistants?
Yeah, it just saves so much mental bandwidth, right? Definitely big on the recurring processes. So it's like, hey, every week, this is going to be a task of yours. You know, it's the monthly or weekly reports, or, you know, formatting this blog post or installing this lead magnet, stuff that's the same over and over again. Super helpful to have some support with. A lot of times, you know, another guy is like the article writer. Like, so he'll do the show notes, and that like automatically every new episode gets automatically sent to him when it uploads to a certain like Dropbox folder. There's a lot of kind of those ongoing repetitive processes that you know, just don't have to worry about. Like they've been, the team members have been really reliable there. You talked about this a little bit. Do you see a point where you don't have to worry about this conflict of interest, where Paychecks and Balances is the full-time thing? I know you're in the Bay where it's crazy expensive, but you know, what would it take to get there?
Ooh, I love this question, and I love that you're interviewing me back. So I do see a point in time where I'll be able to walk away from the day job comfortably. And I do have a dollar amount in mind. I do have, and it's much more a dollar amount than in 12 months. And this is what I used to do. I used to be like, in 12 months, I am going to walk away. Life happens over those next 12 months, not quite where I want to be. And walking away seems like a really irresponsible thing to do, particularly in the Bay Area.
Yeah. Are you talking dollar amount in like savings, nest egg, or like monthly revenue from the business?
I'm talking dollar amount in savings.
Okay.
So even though I plan to stop working for the man at some point in the coming years, I still do think about what I want to have in retirement. And I also know that at retirement age, I do not plan to be living in the Bay Area for retirement. I will be somewhere a lot cheaper. It will not be Albany, New York, where I grew up, but okay. I'll be somewhere where it's a lot less expensive. And so my thing is, I'm approaching it as if what I need to have in retirement is accounting for what I would need to have in retirement for the Bay Area, so that when I move somewhere else, and even if that's within the next few years, I think to myself that if I have a year or whatever it is, 18 months, really a year of living expenses saved, and I'm comfortable with where I am as far as my progress toward retirement, and then that same 1 year of income, I could move to another city, and that 1 year of runway that I have could take me 2 years to burn through, or 2.5 years to burn through. I'm probably taking a little bit of a different approach with it, especially since I have a significant other, and I know that kind of where she wants to be over the next few years. And so I know that I'm going to be in this geographic location, at least for the next few years. And so I'm probably saving more aggressively than I need to. Well, no, there's no such thing as saving more aggressively than you need to. Save all that you can. But I'm saving with a Bay Area mind state, which does make it more challenging given how expensive things are out here. And that's all the more aggressive in terms of what I want to see that I have tucked away between my 401k and my taxable investment accounts. But I'm also thinking it would be great to be in a position that should we decide to move somewhere, and let's say for whatever reason, I'm still working and I need to transfer to another Google office, I can start phasing that out. And I hope no one from work is listening to it, but I can kind of start like phasing out and thinking, you know what, we've moved, making good money, and now that 1 year of runway is going to take 2 years, I feel comfortable making this leap and knowing that if yeah. anything crazy comes up in life, I'll have it covered. Because there's having living expenses, but there's also things like my mom is getting older. My mom is in her 70s now, and a lot of my other family members are getting older. And so for me, there've already been a number of times over the past few years where I'm having to like rush home for because somebody is sick or yeah. there's a funeral, or you know, if I have a health thing that randomly comes up. I remember one time I randomly got like a blood clot, and everything ultimately turned out fine and I'm good. But if there's a catastrophe and I'm only thinking about 1 year of financial runway for the business, I want to make sure that I also have runway in case anything else comes up in life. And I mean, there's other things like, you know, getting married, you know, weddings, or buying a home, or kids come into the picture. So I want to make sure that I have enough tucked away to feel comfortable in terms of my normal operating expenses, but also feeling comfortable in terms of if I have an emergency. And I think I'm at a point right now where I could walk away and be good for some amount of time and focus fully on the podcast and the business, but my personal risk tolerance is not quite there yet. Like, I want to feel good about it. I want to feel comfortable about it. And I know people say that there is never a right time. You can always keep on working. And that's why I say I had to put kind of a dollar amount in mind in terms of where I want to catch up with on my retirement savings. And I'll admit it, I'm not where I'm supposed to be. I mentioned that I only really became responsible in the past few years. So there's compounding that I'm not able to take an advantage of because I did start a little late in terms of getting the full 401k contribution from work. So I'm focused, one, on playing catch up on my 401k and retirement, even though I ultimately plan to not be working for the man for the rest of my life. But then two, I'm also trying to create this regular expense runway and then also kind of this separate emergency fund. You know, car breaks down, car completely dies, got to buy a new car. And when it comes time for me to buy a new car, I want to be able to buy that car in cash. I don't want to get a car note. I want to be able to say, here's the budget. And I actually do, and I'm not sure if you do this, but I actually have different savings accounts for all the various things right now. So I have a car expense account. And within that, I also contribute money thinking about the future when I will need to get a new car. And hopefully that's like at least 5 years from now. I have a vacation account because travel is becoming increasingly important to me. Life experiences in general are becoming more important to me. And maybe that's the millennial flair, though I don't like avocado and avocado toast is not part of my life. I have a business account for the show starter, my podcast website. And I have a couple of other savings accounts and then also an operating account. And so for all these accounts, there's a number I want to see them get to. And that number is baked into that bigger number that I'm trying to get to, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it, to have something. You got to have a goal to shoot for. Otherwise, you never know. But it's like, yeah, I can get a sense of like, well, just one more year. You know, hey, I'm going to be in the Bay Area anyways. It's not, I don't hate work, so I might as well keep going. It's hard to walk away from. My wife's kind of in the same position where it's like, you know, I don't hate it. They pay me well, you know, I don't want to stay at home with the kids all day. So what else am I going to do? There's definitely an element to that. You mentioned one thing, like, I hope no one from work listens to this. I imagine the company, the size that it is, you do have people from work listening. So like, what's that been like? Does the boss know about this project?
It's funny. I say, I hope no one's listening, but I'm at that point now where I openly talk about the podcast. I'm actually in the process of researching starting an internal podcast the team and division, which is, I mean, and I've been in this role now for, I think I want to say since June. So it's been a number of months now and everyone knows about it. It comes up. It's funny because a lot of the vacation time that I use for the gig now is actually for traveling to conferences. And so, you know, like conferences, they're cool, but it's not really vacation unless you add on time. So I know we've had a couple of conferences that have been in Orlando. So if you add on time to go to Disney and do all that other stuff, then it becomes a vacation. But for me, and people are like, oh, did was it a relaxing time? I'm like, well, it was productive.
Like 16-hour days.
yeah, it was 16-hour days. As you can hear, I've lost my voice. And that's just a natural part of the story. And I think like some years ago, there was a point in time where I didn't want to talk about it because I didn't want to create this conflict of interest. And, you know, I didn't want to get fired for something I said on the podcast. And there was a point in time where we talked about topics unrelated to personal finance and professional development that could have been a bit more dicey. And I didn't want someone to find something and then go viral on Friday, be fired on Monday, as we like to say on the show. But I'm at a point now where if I can't talk about something that I do outside of work that means so much to me, and I'm shunned for that, or I feel like that's something that I need to withhold from people, then that's not a place that I need to be.
Right.
Yeah. And it took some years to get comfortable with that. And I think part of even why I transitioned to the role that I'm in now is because I was thinking to myself, I'm not bringing my full self to work. And so I was a staffing manager before. I had a team of recruiters that went out and hired software engineers, and staffing in HR is essentially what I had done for a number of years. And so I knew it. I did it well, but I also didn't feel like I was learning. And I felt like I wasn't even flexing 50% of my talents and capabilities, the things that I've picked up from speaking, the things that I picked up from being a podcaster, from setting up websites, from freelance writing. There's all these various skills I had that were just like this separate aspect of life. And part of the reason that I made the transition into this role was because I wanted to be more of my whole self at work. With the role I have now, I'm essentially an internal communications manager. And there's a lot of overlap in terms of thinking about an editorial calendar. How do we want to message this? What's the best way to message this? Okay, there's a major change that's happening. What are all of the various things that we need to think about? What's the process for this? What's the systems for this? Who are the other people that we need to work with? Who are the people that we need to keep out of this because they're going to make it really complicated? And so a lot of those skills that I've been applying outside of work are now used at work, which I'd also say in some ways when I was thinking before, like, I'm going to leave in a year, at that point where I was like, I got to get out of here, I'm going to leave in a year. It was during a time where I loved my team, but I just didn't love the work. And I actually would get home and be so exhausted from the work that I wouldn't have energy to focus on any of the side hustle stuff, or it would be minimal energy. And I wasn't able to give my best effort. And I had to make a conscious decision that, yo, if I want this particular brand to get where I want it to go, and I want the I Am Rich Jones brand to get where I want it to go. Yes, that is a thing. I don't talk about it a lot, but it's in the background. If I want the Showstarter to get where I want it to go, I need to create this mental space. I can't come home and just be exhausted every night. And then the weekend comes around and I'm spending the weekend doing all the adulting tasks that I wasn't able to do during the week because I was working so hard. And now I have no free time and I have no mental energy, and that's not good for anybody. And so that's my long-winded way of explaining how I got into the role that I am now. But then I also think about that in the context of, even though I'm still super busy now, I'm finding more mental space to be able to work on Paychecks and Balances. I'm finding more mental space to be able to work on creating a course. Not exactly finding more time to be able to create a service-based business, which is part of why I enrolled in your courses. I need to figure out how to be able to do this and also juggle what I have now. But yeah, I imagine that there'll be a point in time where it's not just a podcast. There's going to be multiple things that I'm going to be working on. And the podcast is probably what most folks who are listening to this show know me for. But there are other things that I'm super excited about that I want to start tapping into. And so I imagine in a future state, there'll be a point in time where there are three or four things or five or six things that I have my hands in, and you may not necessarily know that I'm responsible for them, but those things are also going to be generating revenue and put me in a position where, you know, I/we are able to live comfortably.
This is fascinating to hear, for one, because I always get this question of like, well, how do I avoid conflict of interest between my day job and my side hustle? How do I keep my boss from knowing about this? It's like, in today's age, you may not need to. And it sounds like the work that you did outside of work helped you land this new role at work, and it's more fulfilling. And it's like, oh, so they not only appreciated you, they valued that, those skills that you learned outside, you know, on somebody else's dollar, essentially. So that's really interesting to hear. And it doesn't have to be, we should probably note too, like a cut and dry thing where like, today's the day I quit. Like maybe there's a transition period, like, oh, maybe I transition to part-time, transition to this other role that's not as busy. Like there's a bunch of different ways to go about it, but I appreciate you sharing that.
I appreciate you asking, man. You got me on my high horse there, and I think I might actually have a course idea out of this.
The other thing that I wanted to point out too is like, okay, there's Paychecks and Balances, there's I Am Rich Jones, there's the Showstarter. Like this is what I'm talking about when opportunities become visible once you're in motion. This is like the entrepreneurial third law of physics or whatever. It's like once you get going, it's hard to stop. Side hustles on side hustles. I see it over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it's just a matter of making things work, getting things to a good place. And that's why I talk about the importance of process and systems, because I want to be able to get things started, get them running. And then while still being very intimately involved, be able to take myself out of it where possible. And even with the podcast, and I don't know if I should say this, but I would love to get to a point where all I really have to do is maybe outline for for who I'm going to be talking to. And we're getting close to this, and I just got to show up and just be on the mic. And I have someone telling me like, hey, here's the plan for this week. Here's where you need to be. This is already taken care of. Boom. And we're slowly getting there. And I'm definitely seeing more of that with the podcast, which is allowing me to think about, okay, so for 2020, what are some of the things that we want to get into more of? Okay, we've talked a lot about debt and this and that. We want to get into talking about making more money. We want to get into doing video. We've been talking about courses and communities and things like this. Everything that we're doing now is essentially laying the infrastructure, is the word that comes to mind. It's creating the infrastructure to be able to go out there and pursue some of these other things. And I know for Marcus, speaking and writing are really big things for him. So he's thinking, how do I create the infrastructure, the time to ensure that everything with P&B is taken care of, but also some of these other things that I'm personally interested in, I have the time or mental space and bandwidth to be able to pursue those things as well. So this is fascinating indeed. I think you've created a whole separate episode out of this. And I have, I think, a couple more questions for you that are related to what we're talking about now. So if somebody has a busy life with things like work, family, other commitments, how do they go about finding the right side hustle and getting started?
So finding the right side hustle, I mean, this is probably the $1 million question, and I don't think there is such thing as the right side hustle or the perfect side hustle. Maybe the perfect side hustle is the one that you're interested in enough to take action on and give it a shot. So for me, it was like, hey, I have $5. I can open up a Google AdWords account and see if see if anybody clicks on these text ads, right? My wife's side hustle is a photography business. And it was like getting up the nerve to post an ad on Craigslist. We'll shoot your wedding. And they had no, you know, she's doing this with a friend of hers. They had no portfolio. They had, you know, outside of like different family shots and stuff, they never shot a wedding before. So these like brides were taking a massive risk on like, hey, this is my wedding. Hopefully I only get one shot at this. And I'm going to hire these unproven photographers. But that's how they got their start. Very low rate, of course, starting out to build that portfolio. But they've like 20x'd their rate since then, now that they have pictures to back up. Like, hey, we're actually pretty good at this. So it's like getting over the inertia to start the thing. Couple exercises that you can go through to start thinking about this is one I'll call the intersection method or the sweet spot method. And this is trying to combine an area of your skills, like what have you been paid to do in the past, or what have you learned outside of work that you think would be valuable? That would be in the skills column. In the interests column, this is like, well, what do you like to do? Like, I don't like the question of like, well, you got to find something you're passionate about, because that stresses me out. Like, I don't know what I'm passionate about. Like, I like a lot of things. I don't know if any of them are my undying passion. But, you know, what are you interested in? What are your hobbies? That'd be column number two. And then column number three, I would think about your network and, or, you know, who do you know, or who do they know? Like your network's network in a certain sense. And the only reason you're thinking about that is like as a potential foot in the door, like for introductions, conversations, interviews, stuff like that. For me, one example was a nonfiction book editing business that I started a few years ago as a side project experiment. And so in the first column under skills, like I had written a couple of business books myself at that point, was a decent English student in school. So like, you know, maybe I could read other people's stuff. And on top of that, like I would notice typos as like I was reading other people's stuff, like not necessarily in my own work, because I still make plenty of them. But like when I'm reading other people's stuff, like, they missed that. Like that was weird. Like, how did they miss that? And then in the second column, I was like, what do you like to do? Well, I like to read business books and self-improvement books in my spare time anyway. So like there was a combination of factors. And then I kind of skipped the third column initially and went straight to freelance marketplace called Fiverr and found my first editing clients on Fiverr. Hey, I'll proofread your nonfiction book. I'll proofread your business book. Or I did it like for a penny a word. And so for, you know, some of these books for 50,000 words, it'd be a $500 project. So ended up being some decent order sizes over there, worked out to be a pretty decent hourly rate, and actually read some really interesting work and some not so interesting work as too, of course. But you know, some of the projects were actually really, really cool to work on.
I love that, man. And I was wondering if you're gonna bring up Fiverr. I know you've had books on there as well, and you have a post on your website that I'll make sure I get in the show notes. And it's I think it's like 200 side hustle ideas, or it's some crazy number. I went and signed up for like six of them and have done nothing with it, but still the point is that it's a super valuable resource. So I'll make sure that I get that into the show notes. And related to what we're talking about now, so you mentioned your wife having a photography business on the side, which I would put in the service-based category. I'd put editing in the service-based category, but then having a book or a course, I'd put that more in the product/passive category. What guidance do you give to people? And it's something I'm struggling with this right now. So how do you decide between going the service-based route where you're trading time for money, and it could be time for good money? And I've done a consulting project for a company to help them relaunch their podcast, and it paid a pretty good chunk this year, but I was also, because the client was on the East Coast, I was also getting up at 5 a.m. for 6 a.m. calls because the people that I needed in the room on the client side were free at 9 a.m. their time. Sometimes I have to wake up early because I don't want to jump on a call and there's a CEO in the room and I got sleep in my eyes and I'm not fully awake. So I'd have to wake up even earlier. And while I loved the content, I loved working with that client, I realized that getting up and doing a essentially 5 to 8 a.m., then showering and going to my day job, like I was dying from doing that.
Oh, interesting. Now, how did that client find you? How did you find them?
I met him at FinCon. I was at one of those dinners.
Okay.
This actually ties in perfectly. They happened to mention that they were working through relaunching their podcast and asked if we knew anybody who could help with that. And then I was like, well, actually.
Yeah, your spidey sense starts going off. You're like, hey, wait a minute.
And so I ended up putting together a proposal and I went through all the imposter syndrome and am I capable and so on. But ultimately, I got through that inertia and ended up submitting a proposal, going back and forth with them. And it was all like the behind the scenes process pitching. It was all things that I enjoy doing. And it's a topic that I know really well. And so that then turned into, I want to say it was like a 3-month project. And it's essentially going to become the foundation for one of the course ideas that I have that I'm working toward putting together on the podcast side of things. But I say it ties together perfectly because it was being around people who were doing similar things or doing things similar to what I'm interested in, just having conversations, learning what people are about and what type of things they're struggling with. And then just within that conversation, something came up that I could say, hey, I'm super knowledgeable on that. And it started a dialogue. And then that turned into the most money that I've ever made from a consulting gig. It just so happens that the model in which I did that, it was not sustainable over the long term, at least not while I have a day job. And then I thought to myself, maybe I could do this quarterly. But then as work got busier and I'm thinking to myself, the day job is what pays the bills and provides the benefits. Even though I have other things that I'm super interested in and want to work on, I need to be able to do my best at work because, one, I get performance reviews and those performance reviews are tied to my bonuses. My bonuses is tied to my bank account. My bank account is tied to the long-term savings goals. So I need to be able to put forth the most effort there. And that's kind of why I started thinking more about the course route. And I've signed up for other things. I've thought about driving for different services and doing experiments similar to probably what you've done in the past. But then I'm also thinking, like, even today, I'm like, man, I'm getting ready to travel for work for a week. I got to get my workout in. I got to do these early party things that are happening this weekend that I committed to. Like, I don't have time for that. And it's going to be months where I don't have time for that. Whereas if I created something where, let's say, I put in a few weeks to create a course or a product or something and put that out there. And yes, I would still have to continuously market it because I don't believe in the, if you put it out there, they will, if you build it, they will come. Like, no, if you build it and market it, they will come. And then maybe they might buy if you market it the right way. There's a lot of work there as well. Part of the struggle is there are these little things I could do to trade time for money. Even I've thought about doing career consulting again, but then a lot of the folks that listen to the podcast are based on the East Coast. So it would be the same trap where now it's easier for them to talk after work. And so it's 9 a.m. East Coast time. It's 6 p.m. West Coast time. I'm rushing home from work to jump on a client call and I'm drained from the workday. So I can't even be my full self and have my full level of energy because I'm so tired from work. And so that's kind of why I asked the question of how does somebody figure out, and maybe somewhere in there I answered it, but how does somebody figure out whether they should be trying to go the service-based route, which is the easiest to start? And I think you'd probably agree on that.
Yeah, I believe that's the easiest to start, probably the fastest to start. Because like you said, you don't have to build a course. You don't have to build an audience to sell a course to. There's a lot of advantage of doing that. And like you said, this is the most I've ever made from a consulting gig. Like it can be a fantastic hourly rate. And you ask the key question, well, I was just talking to them and found out what they were struggling with. Like that's the key. Like people are going to spend money to solve problems. And it doesn't have to be a big corporation. It could be an individual that just needs their lawn mowed once a week, right? Like that could be a problem. Talked to a guy from the Facebook group who started a dog poop pickup business. It was like, that's what are thing? People struggling with? They don't want to go to the backyard and pick up their dog's poop. Like, well, you know what? I can drive around once a week and do that for you. Very simple stuff. That's probably where most people start. Now, if you're in the position where you don't necessarily need to see cash flow right away, where you have the time and energy to invest in a longer term play. That's where something like the podcast comes in. That's where something like the blog or website or YouTube channel comes in, where it's like, I'm going to put in this effort up front, fully expecting not to see any monetary return on that for potentially months, maybe even years. It was probably 8 or 9 months, like, before I saw any meaningful cash flow from Side Hustle Nation. Like, it can be a long play. And if you're not going into it with that mindset, like, you're going to quit before you ever get there. The other model that we talked about, digital products with books and courses and stuff. There's a model that can help you get started. And this is super common as well. It's just, you know, maybe the fastest way to multiply money. Like, we talked about dividend stocks and, like, getting excited about a 4% yield. Like, you know, I know people who can turn $10 into $100, like, just through, you know, knowing what to buy and where to resell it. I mean, you probably met Rob and Melissa from Flea Market Flipper at one of these FinCons over the years. Like, they're my, like, favorite people because they are experts at multiplying money and the deals they find. It's insane. They make a full-time six-figure living, like, just buying and selling random stuff. And you're like, hey, anybody can do this. It just takes the time to go out and make it happen. And for them, started as a side project. Look, every weekend, going to the flea market, can see what I can find, see what it's worth on eBay, and turn around and sell it.
I love that, man. I love that. And I've really loved this conversation that we have. Still loving that you've asked me a few questions, because I think there are some learnings that I hadn't really even thought about that'll be helpful for me. And I hope, most importantly, helpful for the audience. So we are heading to the end of this conversation, and I did want to talk a little bit more about Side Hustle Nation real quick. So I know it's a podcast, it's also a blog, and then I know you also have a pretty engaged, actually, it's probably one of the most engaged Facebook groups that I'm a part of. I mean, every time I log in, I've always got at least one notification, and more times than not, it'll be for something in your group that I also find to be super helpful, or it relates in some way. And there have been several times over the past couple of months where I've just been thinking about something. And rather than be the person, and this is not shade, but I hate when people go into a Facebook group and they have a question and they don't search to see if that question has been answered first. And people keep asking the same basic question over and over again. But also within that, if you pay attention to what people are asking over and over again, that can give you potential ideas for something that you can offer.
Yeah, it's an endless stream of content ideas for sure.
Yeah. And I've went into your group and there have been times where I've just had, you know, a question about something or course software, whatever it is. And I've been able to search it and I see that somebody or multiple somebodies have asked about it and been able to get an answer to it. So can you talk a little bit about your community and then kind of what you have coming up or what you're thinking about for 2020?
Sure. So the group, this is sidehustlenation.com/FB. We'll redirect you over there. This is the Side Hustle Nation community on Facebook. I think we're 15,000 people strong. It's been really rewarding to me because since the early days, I said, like, this is Side Hustle Nation. Like, this is the community for people building businesses in their spare time. But I never acted like that. For the first couple of years, like, it was very much like one to many, like me broadcasting out on the podcast, on the blog. Like, I said community, or I thought community, but didn't act like it. And when I finally turned on or created the Facebook group, and I was hesitant to do that. I think there's already a bunch of entrepreneurial Facebook groups. Like, do people really need another? So I was kind of hesitant to turn it on, but, you know, getting over that imposter syndrome and actually creating it, it's become a really cool hub of, you know, audience members interacting with each other, like, not necessarily with my direct involvement. Like, they're asking and answering questions. And there's been increasingly lately a little bit of a moderation challenge in there as the group has grown. But for the early days, like, it didn't have any of that. It was really interesting. Like, you know, nobody was coming in spamming it up, which I thought would happen. I figured, like, that would, you know, be, it just, like, I was wary of adding more time to my week, like, going in, you know, making a moderation task for myself. But that hasn't been the case. It's been really rewarding to see the conversations happening. And you know, just, it's another touch point. You know, here's, you know, once people log in, like you say, there's a notification for Side Hustle Nation, like, that gets you, you know, top of mind once again. So definitely been a powerful addition to the brand.
Yes. So definitely encourage people to check that out. And Nick, where else can people find you around the internet?
Well, I think you mentioned sidehustlenation.com/ideas. That is the constantly updated laundry list of part-time business ideas, creative ways to make extra money. There's no opt-in required over there. Just my goal for that page is that you have 10 tabs open by the time you get to the bottom. Like, I could do that. I could do that. That sounds interesting.
I had 15. It was its own window of tabs. And I'm the person who doesn't shut my computer down for a while. And so I came back like a week later and I was like, what is this window? And it was just all these different websites. And I was like, freaking Nick, man.
I love it. I love it. So that's the goal there. And of course, we'd love to have you tune in to the Side Hustle Show wherever podcasts are sold.
Well, Nick, it's been awesome to have you on the podcast. Really appreciate it, man.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Nick for coming on the podcast. If you'd like to check out his list of 99 plus side hustle ideas, visit sidehustlenation.com/ideas. And keeping it candid, that chat with Nick got me thinking about a side hustle I've been thinking about for a long while now. And I've made more progress since that conversation, which is a matter of weeks at this point, than I probably made in the last year. So also special shout out to him for that. And if you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to share with your network and hit us with those 5 stars in Apple Podcasts and say a few words about the show. Today's review of the week comes from Panamami. And the review reads, MZ, not sure what that stands for, Millennial Zennial? I don't know. Very informative podcast. I look forward to each episode so I can learn more about finances, savings, etc. So much to know and learn. Keep up the great work. So Panamami, really appreciate those 5 stars. And you keep up the great work yourself. And if you'd like to find us on social, we're on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances. You can follow our individual accounts at TheMarcusGarrett, 1T on Twitter, 2Ts everywhere else. And I am available at IamRichJones. So again, want to thank everyone for listening to this episode. Hope you got a lot out of it, and we'll be back next week to close out the year. And until then, be safe. We out. Peace. Or I guess I'm out. Peace.